This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Christy Allen. I'm one of the professors. It's kind of hard for me to say that because I don't feel that old, but at UCSF, and I'm one of the sports faculty, and I'm operative surgeon, so if things are skewed operatively, you'll know why. But most of the injuries in this talk are operative, and we'll talk about those things. Cartilage, arthritis issues, things like that are talked about in separate topics by some of the other lecturers, so we're not really going to talk about that issue as much. These are the acute injuries of generally sports-related, and kind of how to kind of pick them out and sort them out. And, you know, if you have yourself or one of your family members, hopefully you'll be able to pick up some of these clues from things so that they don't miss being diagnosed, since you guys are supposed to be like med students, right? So so that being said, I'm going to start talking about some of these injuries. So you may have been over this kind of knee anatomy 101 model in some of the other lectures, since I don't have privilege for the other lecturers' talks. With the knee flexed or bent a little bit, the kneecap sits up, and we're looking at the bottom surface of the femur. This is looking at it when the knee is straight. And this is the articular cartilage of the knee, different from the meniscus cartilage in terms of how hard it is. Actually, articular cartilage normally is kind of like linoleum. It's pretty hard. It's supposed to reduce stress between the bones. When it has divots and complete loss of cartilage, that's when we get into an arthritic state. And patients always want to ask me if they have a cartilage divot, am I arthritic? And it's a continuum, actually. When cartilage gets worn down, it starts getting soft and it gets thin. And then when bone's exposed, technically, that's early arthritis. And full-blown arthritis is when there's no cartilage on the end of the bone in a lot of areas, and that's when you start seeing changes on x-ray. But in addition to this articular cartilage, there's Cushing's, the menisci, and there's actually two of them in each knee. The medial one, which is to the inside of your knee, and the lateral one, which is to the outside. And they can get tears. We're going to talk about that in a little later. There's other ligaments in the knee. And this is a very simplistic model. The medial collateral ligament to the inside and the lateral collateral ligament to the outside. And then the important cruciate ligaments, which you can see they cross. That's why they're called cruciate. And the anterior cruciate ligament and the posterior cruciate ligament in the knee. This one always gets a lot of press. The other one doesn't, because it doesn't cause as much problems when people get a tear of it, unless it's in combination with something else. There's a couple things that are missing in this picture, such as the retinaculum that keeps the kneecap centered. And that can be important, actually, when someone dislocates their kneecap, but it's not really shown in the model. When someone has a significant injury like an anterior cruciate ligament tear, people twist their knee really forcefully, and they can tear lots of these ligaments, the medial collateral ligament, menisci, ACL. Sometimes it can twist the other way, and you can tear the lateral collateral ligament. So we're going to talk about these different types of traumatic injuries and what to look for and how we generally treat them in orthopedics. So there's lots of knee issues. Some of them stratify into things that are non-operatively treated, like the things on the left, with few exceptions. These are kind of the overused category of injuries. Patellar tracking problems or kneecap pain or the old-fashioned chondromalacia patella that you may have heard of. Usually that's just anterior knee pain, pain in the front of the knee with walking downstairs, sitting for long periods. Patellar tendon issues, oftentimes from weightlifting or repetitive jumping type of activities. Hamstring injuries can be strains from sprinting and running. There are some of these, they're pretty rare, where they actually can tear off the bone, and those ones are surgical. Bursitis is just swelling in the front of the knee in front of the actual joint, oftentimes from kneeling too long or sometimes diving on your knee in wrestlers. And iliotibial band friction syndrome, which is most commonly seen in people who run a lot, and they have the slow onset of increasing pain to the outside of the knee with running. Oftentimes when they start running, it doesn't hurt, and then by mile 3, it hurts. And sometimes people that bike longer distances, the people that do like 20, 30 miles can get these problems. But as you notice, the theme for most of these is overuse, doing too much, maybe bad technique in terms of training for a lot of people for these problems. Now, on the right side are the more traumatic type problems that we see in sports medicine. Meniscus tears, ligament injuries, kneecap popping out or patella instability, certain types of tendon injuries. Cartilage, I call them dings, but cartilage injuries that are fresh, that just happen. So how do we differentiate these when someone comes into the office? Well, I go through a whole litany. If you guys just remember this, when someone's telling you about their bad knee problem, you'll get pretty far. I go through a whole litany of questions when I'm talking to a patient trying to figure out what is going on with their knee. And sometimes, especially with my teenagers, it's not so easy to get these answers out of them. How did the injury happen? Was it a sudden thing, or did it happen slowly, insidiously? That gives me an indication of which side of that chart, that last screen, where they fall in that. Where does it hurt? My teenage patients will say, my knee, kind of sarcastically, and then you're like, when they want to put in dummy at the end. But, you know, I want to know specifically for them to point to a spot as to where it hurts, because even if the patient can tell me where it hurts, that is going to get me pretty far in terms of figuring out what the problem is. And this is sometimes very hard to get people to talk about. Sometimes people are very self-unaware. They know their knee hurts, but they don't really have any idea the location of it, which is kind of surprising. Did you hear or feel a pop, a snapping sound? That does not bode well. There's several things that when something pops, that's not a good thing. Not crackling or what we call crepitus, but like an absolute pop. When someone tears their ACL, oftentimes people playing around them on the soccer field will hear something that sounds like a pencil snapping. And it's a little, I've been around several people because I played soccer, who've torn their ACL, and you hear this crack and you're like, oh, I know what that means. Did the person have swelling? Important questions. One of the ones we teach our schedulers is like, how much swelling did you have after the injury and how fast did it happen? This is an important question because swelling that's slow over a day or two often implies a less serious injury. Immediate swelling, especially in the knee, implies that there's bleeding going on in the joint. You know, the knee has what didn't show up on that model that I showed you earlier, the knee has a capsule or a lining around it, kind of like an imaginary balloon, and it keeps all the fluid in most cases. So if someone has a lot of swelling within a few hours after an injury, it makes it get very tense, and it almost looks like a grapefruit. And generally, when someone has rapid onset of swelling within a few hours, that implies that there's bleeding in the joint, either a ligament within the knee tore or a fracture occurred, or a tendon ruptured that's within the knee joint, like the quad or patellar tendon. Meniscus tears, in most cases, just cause gradual swelling overnight. And people have swelling the next day. They wake up and they're like, wow, their knee is swollen. But when people have significant knee injuries, the knee gets tense, looks like a grapefruit, can't even see where the kneecap ends and the swelling starts. So there's a big difference. And that, you know, that's a red flag to our schedulers that if someone has immediate swelling, we need to get them in right away, because that's something probably that is going to need to be addressed very quickly, and it can't wait, you know, 2 weeks for the next available appointment. Does someone have locking or an inability to go through all their motion? Are they really stiff, or can they not straighten their knee out all the way? Those are a little bit red flags that they may have a loose body in their knee that's locking their knee out. Maybe they have a meniscus tear that's flipped over on itself, a specific type of meniscus tear, and they can't straighten their knee out. Sometimes people get stiff after a few days, especially if they have a lot of blood in their knee. So that's not uncommon, but an immediate inability right after an injury to straighten out the knee, like that time zero, is concerning for us that there's something else going on. And then what problems make the symptoms worse or better? You know, if rest and not walking and, doing stationary bike instead of running makes it feel better, and then we think about maybe more overuse type of syndrome. If people say putting my leg up and not even putting weight on it, then you think it's much more serious than that. So I ask these questions, and I'm hoping that I'll get 90% of the diagnosis just by asking the right questions. And we try to teach our residents to do this in terms of trying to get to the diagnosis. And then the exam, the physical exam, is just confirming the diagnosis. So again, swelling, like this slide, suggests that there's something going on within the knee. And then we have to consider how, this is a slide that's not on your handout, I added it for fun. I want to consider how quickly did it happen. If it happened within, you know, a few hours, two to three hours within the after the injury, that makes me think it's bleeding in the joint and it's a significant injury. Kneecap cartilage wear, or what we call the patellofemoral pains, often just slow swelling over a few days. Meniscus tears tend to be over 1 to 2 days. So these are the things that we worry about when someone has immediate onset of swelling and a tense, what we call tense effusion, or a lot of swelling in the knee, and the knee looks like a grapefruit. And we're going to go through these, okay? I talked about a lock joint. So we're going to talk about, first of all, foremost, traumatic knee injuries and the problems. This is a knee dislocation, which is not good because that means they tore more than two ligaments in the knee. That guy needs surgery right away. But these are the ones we're going to go over, the traumatic injuries. Okay, so I'm going to make this interactive because I hate just talking to a group, especially when there's a bright headlight in my face. So don't be shy. Guys, I don't know if anybody else has been interactive, but I want you to read the question, and then I'll read the question so nobody feels pressured about their reading skills, and then I'll have everybody raise their hand what they think the answer is. 35-year-old recreational basketball player makes a rapid pivot or change of direction on his fixed leg and feels a tearing sensation in his knee. He tries to keep playing, but he has a moderate amount of discomfort in his knee along the inside part of his knee. His knee swells a moderate amount over the few days. Already got a clue there. He notes pain along the joint line with squatting deep and climbing up and down stairs. The most likely diagnosis is A, meniscus tear. This is going to be one of those nobody's going to raise their hands. Okay, A, good. B, patellar tendon rupture. Good. C, chondromalacia patella or patella maltracking. Kneecap pain, or D, ACL tear. Okay. That's pretty good. All right. So pain, the answer is A, which I'd say about 80% of the participating audience got right. All right. So meniscus tears, those cartilage pad tears, annoying things that are the bane of our existence, oftentimes caused by basically rotation of the femur on the tibia, and the poor meniscus is caught in the crossfire and you get a tear. A twisting type of injury. Oftentimes a patient will tell me they change direction. Patient today said her husband took her out playing some holiday game, trying to get the $100 prize, took her out, and she twisted her knee. When I examine patients or when they complain about where their pain is, they say it's pain along the joint line where that meniscus is. Sometimes they feel like their knee gives way because of pain. They may have actually clicking when the meniscus tear kind of catches. And sometimes when it's a bad enough tear, the knee might get locked up and they can't straighten their knee up. Not in all cases. But joint line pain, I'm not going to show you my legs, but joint line pain, front of the knee is kneecap until proven otherwise, but the menisci are over here. There's one to the inside and one to the outside. Medial meniscus, lateral meniscus. So you have two in each knee, hopefully. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So patient, when they have tear, they oftentimes have discomfort when I push on that spot. But they also will complain of pain, oftentimes squatting down to pick something up, again, over where the tear is, not in the front, because that's kneecap pain. Or when they twist, sometimes I'll ask people, does it hurt when you plant your foot and go to get in the car over where the meniscus tear is? So on an MRI, this is why we get MRIs, because they're really good at picking up meniscus tears. A normal meniscus has, it's shaped like this, so it has a front part and a back, front part and a back part. And a normal meniscus is jet black and nice and healthy, no bright white signals going completely through it. So in this patient over here, their MRI, the back part of the meniscus has a horizontal tear, which can cause pain with twisting motions or squatting, things like that. And the reason why they hurt is not because the meniscus has nerves in it, it's because when you flex or you twist on it, it compresses it and then torques on it. It's like kind of like pulling on a piece of paper that's torn. It pulls on that, and then it pulls on the lining of the knee joint, that capsule I was talking about before, and that's where all the nerves are. So patients have discomfort when they torque and twist because it pulls on that. So what do we do if we have a tear? Sometimes we trim them, depending on it. And especially as patients get older, they kind of have, they're kind of wear and tear meniscus tears. They get degenerative meniscus tears due to, they just kind of give out over time sometimes, or you just have a little twisting injury and you can get a tear. So what we do with those when they're not fixable is we trim the part minimally that causes the symptoms. Like this patient has a little flap tear. This person has a little fraying of the meniscus. But we want to trim as little as possible because that meniscus is important because it's our shock absorber between this nice articular cartilage. See how nice it looks? It looks like linoleum when it's in good shape. So now if the tear is big and it's out to the periphery, so the tear is back here, right where the capsule is, or in the front, or on the side, near the blood supply, we'll oftentimes try to repair it with suture. Because if we try to trim a tear that's way out here, we're going to take most of the meniscus out. So this part, when you're in here, we usually trim. If the tear is way out here, where the blood supply is closest to it, oftentimes we'll fix the meniscus. So sometimes it gets confusing because patients always think it's always fixed, but there's trimming and then there's repair. So in those cases, and this is how we decide, this is way back when there was a study looking at the meniscus and what the blood supply was, and this guy injected India ink into the blood vessels. So out to the periphery, out to the sides of the knee, the blood supply is really good, but as you get in the middle of it, it peters out. So tears in here we trim, tears out here we repair with suture. So you always wonder, why do we fix things and why do we trim things? That's why. So I'll skip this thing. There's different types of tear patterns, but so then we have the things we repair are things out here in what we call the red zone because it has a blood supply. Sometimes in kids, we'll push the envelope and do repairs in this zone because they have the red-white zone, and kids heal like starfish. And then oftentimes in this area where we get flap tears or little tears that fold underneath and cause a lot of symptoms, we'll just trim those. So these are a few examples of different types of tears. This is a flap tear, and we just trim it with a little biter. These things look enormous, but they're only about 4 millimeters in size, these instruments that we put in the joint. And we look with a little camera, an arthroscope that's about the size of a pencil, basically, through two little incisions, and we do all the work. Now, this is a horizontal tear, like that MRI picture we showed, and we trim this. But sometimes the whole back of the meniscus can tear and flip in front. And that's called a bucket handle tear because it's like a bucket handle. And when this whole piece from the back of the meniscus is flipped in the front, that can block people from straightening out their knee. And this usually happens with a traumatic injury. We see this a lot with ski injuries or soccer players that tear their ACL or someone that's had a tear for a while and they just never took care of it. And then all of a sudden one day they squatted down to pick something up and the whole meniscus flips to the front. So we don't want to take that whole big chunk out. So we usually try to fix those acutely. So this is another example of a bucket handle tear. The whole back part's flipped in front. So we push it back where it's supposed to. And then we use these things that look like European torture devices to pass needles through. And if you look really closely, it's kind of dark, but there's a bunch of blue suture way back towards the edge of the knee joint, and we fix it. So as long as the patient's knee, the caveat to this is this cartilage has to be in good condition here and here, because if you got a bunch of potholes or divots or arthritis here or here, this isn't going to really heal because it's going to be too much stress when the patient walks on it. So it has to be someone that their knee in general is in good condition. So, but that's a meniscus repair. You see this, everybody see the sutures? And it's kind of dark, but okay. So this is just a schematic. So you put these big long needles through and pass through across the tear, and then we tie the sutures on the outside of that capsule that we were talking about. So the blood supply comes in from the outside and helps this heal. The dangerous thing about these types of things is all the nerves and blood vessels are in the back of the knee, so we have to be careful about not tying sutures around them because that would be bad. So nowadays, it's a little harder to tell whether someone's had a repair or a trimming of a meniscus because we use these all-inside devices sometimes. We don't pass suture through, and there's not an incision to tie the sutures over the lining of the knee joint. So these are a little bit easier in terms of doing repair. They pass suture through the meniscus, and then they lock a little device on the outside of the capsule, and we can cinch it down and get it to heal. The only problem is this is why medical care costs a lot. Each one of these things, because they're disposable, is like $200 a piece. So it's a lot easier to do those things with the needle, which costs about $10 a piece, than this. But this is faster, and this is what a lot of people do nowadays. All right, so that's meniscus. What do we trim? What do we repair? Now, next one. See how we're getting increasing level of difficulty here. Oh, sorry, I'm not looking at it. Yes?
Could you square that with the study that came out a couple of months ago, and then we heard yesterday that taking things out of the knee and trimming meniscuses and so forth, the rehabs doing it, really aren't shown to have much long-term impact versus doing nothing? There's something I'm not understanding, because I thought yesterday.
You know, it depends on the condition of the knee. Remember I was talking about how good that cartilage is? A lot of those studies are looking at people with arthritic knees that have degenerative meniscus tears, and it's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, I use the analogy, the meniscus is your shock absorbers. The cartilage is the tarmac on the road. If you have bad tarmac on the road and you fix your shock absorber or you trim it, and then you start doing things again, this is the bad potholes are going to chew up those shock absorbers again. If you have good cartilage and a good surface and you fix your shocks, they're going to be good for another 1,000 miles. So it depends on, and it's hard because there's a lot of people that come to see me that are like 50 and they got some cartilage wear and they have a meniscus tear probably because the cartilage kind of chewed it up, and you don't know how their results are going to be with doing an arthroscopy. But if you have someone that's 30 and they have pristine cartilage, or even 50 and they have pristine cartilage, like a patient that came to see me today that had the holiday party accident with her husband kind of twisting her knee, she has great-looking cartilage on her MRI. She just has a meniscus tear. She's going to do well because she doesn't have arthritis in the setting of a meniscus tear. It's the people that have the arthritis and the meniscus tear that I'm like, I don't know how you're going to do. And sometimes I'll send them to physical therapy and give them a cortisone shot and then see how much their symptoms really bother them. So the key is sorting out the symptoms and making sure they're all due to the meniscus and not due to arthritis. And that's the art of medicine, is knowing who's going to do well and not subject them to a surgery that's not going to give them any relief. So I would agree with that. All right, case number two. 20-year-old soccer player attempts to avoid an oncoming defender. You have to know something about soccer with this. By making a rapid cut and change of direction. As she goes to change direction, she hears a loud pop in her knee. She tries to keep playing, but she has a lot of discomfort in her knee. And the next time she tries to plant and pivot, her knee spins out on her and gives way. And her knee swells a lot in the next few hours. Okay, hint, hint. So the most likely diagnosis is A, meniscus tear. Okay. B, patellar tendon rupture. C, that old dreaded patellofemoral pain. Or, instead of C, D, ACL tear. Ooh, you got like going 98% on that one. Okay, you guys are fast learners. Okay, my most common patient presentation, especially since I get a lot of soccer players. So these positions people put them in that they can do a billion times and plant and go to twist, for whatever reason at one point, sometimes ends badly. So how do people tear their ACLs? There are a lot of different ways. You've all seen the gory pictures from basketball games on ESPN and football games. Sometimes it's a clipping injury where a football player gets hit on the outside of his knee and the foot's planted and the knee gets taken out. That's why this is outlawed, because people get an ACL tear and an MCL tear. Sometimes it can be just due to hyperextending and landing awkwardly, which happens a lot in basketball and gymnastics and volleyball. Sometimes it's just plant, go to change direction, Derrick Rose on the Bulls. And sometimes That's pretty much it for that's basketball and soccer and everything else. So let's see if my videos work here. Okay, so this is why gymnasts get ACL tears, because they're supposed to land in hyperextension. So she lands with her foot a little externally rotated, a little bit out of control. And I will do it slow-mo so you can really watch it. So watch her right leg. So the foot's externally rotated, lands, knee gives out, and she tears her ACL and most likely her medial collateral ligament. I'm a soccer player, so I have to show soccer. So Pega goes down into the corner. Her foot gets stuck in the grass, and boom. So a lot, and it's rare to see someone tear their ACL in the rain because their foot doesn't really get stuck, although I did have a lacrosse player the other day do it. I don't know how. But so those are the ones. These are the injuries that, in general, not all the time, which makes it a little bit harder. In general, people get rapid onset of swelling within a few hours because there's a blood vessel that attaches to the ACL. So when that ligament tears, the blood vessel tears, and people get bloody effusion within a few hours in a tense knee. Every once in a while, people come in and they're like, I had this, I felt the pop, but my knee didn't swell. Oh, because I iced, and they don't have much swelling, and then I examine them and they start crying because they know they tore their ACL, and then they're not expecting that diagnosis. So on an MRI, this is an MRI slice right through the middle of the knee, we call sagittal image. This is the ACL. As you can tell, it's a very vulnerable looking structure. Doesn't look the most stout thing in the world. It kind of, to me, it looks like a rubber band strung up between the tibia and the femur, as opposed to the nice stout posterior cruciate ligament, which is about twice as thick. So some people, it's a little bit wider, but this one is pretty narrow. Now on this one, as you can see, the ACL starts out, and then it just abruptly stops, and you never really can follow it up to its attachment on the femur. And this is the most common type of injury pattern, where it tears off the femur and just scars down the posterior cruciate ligament. So I always tell my teenagers, it's like an aimless teenager. It has substance but no direction, because it just starts out and then it just ends. So there can be a lot of different patterns, but that's the most common one. When I look surgically in the knee, the ACL is torn off the femur, off the top, and then just kind of falls down on the posterior cruciate ligament. And the reason why these can't heal like other ligaments in the knee is because it tears off and it just flops down, and it's not staying attached to where it's supposed to stay attached. And in fact, in the old days, you know, probably like 40 years ago, they used to try to sew it back, but that didn't work. Too much injury to the ligament. It doesn't have much healing capability. So this is what I mean by a grapefruit-sized knee. Okay, playing tricks on me. But that's a large effusion. Can't really make the kneecap out. So when I'm first seeing a patient, we don't just go to the operating room with an ACL tear right away, unless there's some other issues that really forces the surgery, like a locked knee, like I was talking about with the bucket handle tear, which can happen with ACL tears. So these are the things that I have to evaluate and look at when I'm thinking about surgery or what we're going to do with the patient. We want to make sure their swelling's down. I want to check their range of motion. I want to check and make sure that there's no other ligaments or ligaments injured or meniscus tears. So generally, after someone tears their ACL, we think first about getting the knee quieted down before we even think about surgery. Unless, like I said, there's extenuating circumstances, like the patient has a meniscus tear that's flipped over on itself. Not every meniscus tear, just that one bucket handle we were talking about. So we want to get motion back, get the swelling down, and have I call it a quiet knee, where the patient can easily bend and straighten the knee. Because if we go in and do the surgery too soon, bad things can happen. In the old days, again, up in Lake Tahoe, they used to operate on people right off the ski slopes for ACL tears. And then they also cast them and all sorts of lovely things. But they used to do that because they thought taking care of the injury right away was the best thing to do. And every once in a while, someone slipped through the cracks and they'd come in, you know, 4 or 5 weeks later. And the therapist started noticing that the patients that had the delayed surgery did much, much better. They got better motion. They weren't so stiff. In fact, the people that had the surgery right away and were put in a cast, oftentimes they had to go back to the operating room to be manipulated because they were so stiff. So people kind of put two and two together and said, maybe we should wait. I wonder how many years it took them to figure that out. But we realized that the patients that had the surgery right away, they would get a lot of scarring after the because of the surgery right after the injury, and the patients that had delayed surgery didn't have so much scarring. And we call that arthrofibrosis, when people have a lot of scarring after surgery and they need manipulation. And I always use my, you know, it's hard sometimes to get this concept over to my younger patients, because they want to, everything's go, go, go. They want to do surgery right away. And sometimes they're like, well, I'm going to go to so-and-so down the street because they're going to do my surgery right away. And I'm like, well, that's not necessarily in your best interest, because I tell them about this information. But I always use the analogy, it's like hitting your thumb with a hammer. It's pissed off, right? Really pretty angry. 5 out of 10 pain if you hit your thumb with a hammer. If you hit it with a hammer 2 weeks later, well, it's 5 out of 10 pain again. If you hit it 2 minutes later, it's like 15 out of 10 pain, because you've already, it's already angry and throbbing, and then you do more damage to it. So if we do surgery right on top of a bad knee injury, the knee does not respond well to it. So in rare cases, only when we're forced to because there's another injury more pressing, do we do surgery immediately with ACL surgery, with ACL tears. Okay, so who do we usually do surgery on for ACL surgery? For ACL tears, I mean, usually high demand patients. And by that, it doesn't mean like the person that's the whiniest in the office. I mean, which sometimes is the case. I should maybe change it to high maintenance patients. It's patients that really need their knee for a lot of high demand type of activities, such as professional athletes, people that do cutting and pivoting sports. But sometimes that high demand can be due to the person's job. You know, if you're a fireman, or even if you're someone who's a roofer, that you need to be able to rely on that knee, and you don't want it giving out on you. If you're up on a roof or a high structure, if you're a policeman that's going to be chasing after some criminal, you don't want to be going to try change direction, run around a corner, and all of a sudden your knee pivot shifts on you. And it really makes your knee give out. The patients describe when they have instability due to an ACL tear that their knee feels like it does this when they go to change direction, or their knee spins out on them. As opposed to when patients describe instability due to pain, it's like that. So it's a different type of instability. Rarely, sometimes patients just have instability with activities of daily living. Generally, physical therapy can take care of this. In fact, people can actually run, bike, and swim, do linear sports, without an ACL. I have tons of patients that never had surgery because they do the triathlon sports. Now, it may be that they have cartilage wear that's preventing them from running or something like that, but they should be able to do running or biking and swimming without having an ACL. Sometimes patients are like, well, I have an ACL. I have to have surgery. I'm like, no, you don't. You're a couch potato and you never even go to the gym, and you weigh 250 pounds and you're 5 feet tall. You don't need to have your ACL surgery. In fact, you know, people, that type of patient, it might not be a great idea to do the surgery in the first place, because, you know, this is a big surgery and a big recovery, and people basically have to be a gym rat to recover from it fully, in my opinion. So getting on the subject of, I should probably put couch potato watches, you know, The Bachelor every Monday night like me. People that do triathlon sports, theoretically you could tell them you don't really need your ACL. Now, younger patients that only do those types of sports, really hard for me to tell them, you don't need your ACL, because I never know when they're 22 what they're going to take up when they're 28. You know, and you can tell patients don't do cutting pivoting sports, and then 2 months later they all of a sudden decide to take up taekwondo with spin kicks, and they completely forget that they don't have a knee that's stable enough to do that. So it's a little harder for me to ethically tell them, you don't need your ACL, because I don't know what other activities they're going to end up doing later on in life. There are some rare people out there that we call copers that have no ACL, and they do cutting pivoting sports. The hard part is figuring out who these people are without having them severely damage their knee. There are some reports, which everybody always points to, about, so-and-so's in the NBA, and he doesn't even have an ACL in either knee. Hines Ward, this is dating myself a little bit, that played for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he's now retired. Nobody knew he didn't have an ACL until he went to the NFL Combine, and they checked his knees. And he had torn it probably when he was 10 years old, and he remembered some vague remote injury, but he had grown up without the ACL, and he coped by keeping all his surrounding muscles really strong. So he had a stable knee because he was relying on all those other structures to keep it stable. So people can be copers, but it's really hard if someone tears their ACL when they're 18 and trying to sort out, oh, well, we'll just send you to physical therapy and see how you do, because every time that knee shifts, they can do new damage if they have more episodes. So it's, we generally recommend that people get ACL surgery when they're active. And then the bottom one, which I frequently have because I have the 10 to 13-year-old set coming into my office with their ACL tears, kids with open growth plates are a tough problem to solve. Sometimes when we do the surgery, which you'll see in a second, we drill these holes across their bone and across their growth plates, and that can cause premature growth plate arrest and cause problems with their the way their knees are aligned. And so in the young kids, especially young boys that are still growing that have ACL tears, sometimes we try to just do bracing and activity modification, which you know how that goes with a 12-year-old. Don't play soccer, you know. And the next thing you know, they're out in the backyard kicking a ball around with their brother. So this is a tough group in terms of figuring out what to do. So we have all these special surgeries that we do for kids. Go ahead. I see you, yeah.
Okay,
you're on the edge.
Two questions. One, outer age range for ACL.
You mean upper or?
Upper.
It's not an age, it's based on physiologic age. You know, we all know that there are 28-year-old couch potatoes that don't do a lick of exercise, that really don't need ACL surgery, and that you may know your neighbor that's an aggressive skier that's 65 years old. I don't know if I would do it. I think there's a certain point where you can tell people, look, you need to just maybe give this up. And, you know, maybe skiing isn't the best thing. Or maybe you just wear a functional brace that makes you stable for that one sport that you do. The problem is that I find is when people, as patients get older, and we all know this, is surgery, kids heal like starfish. And as we get a little older, even women in their mid-30s, patients struggle with stiffness after knee surgery a lot. And as the older the patient, the more of a struggle that is. And you're balancing this, okay, we're trying to get this person back to sports versus are they going to do well with the surgery? So that's the hard part for me. Even I find that women that are 35 that have ACL surgery seem to struggle more with their male counterparts in terms of getting their motion back, even right after the injury, before surgery. So there's this balance. And I try to maximize the outcome in terms of doing things to help them with their motion and getting them passive motion machines and things like that. But I just noticed that, you know, sometimes you got to be really careful with patients as they get a little bit older about making sure they know that they could get stiff and they may not get all their motion back. And maybe they should think about the cost benefit of, like, can they drop this sport that they're participating in, or they really want to do it and they're insistent on doing it. I've never done ACL surgery in anybody older than, I think, 62. So, but there's no hard, fast rule. It really depends on the physiologic age of the person, too. So,
yeah,
does that help?
Question.
Okay.
There's some questions, longitudinal follow-ups on ACL versus reconstruction versus no
surgery. Well, there's a Swedish study. But what is the question?
After 10, 12 years, what difference?
You know, you don't have a comparison group that does the exact same thing as the person who had surgery and didn't have surgery. So that's the hard part. You can tell an 18-year-old don't do cutting pivoting sports, and some of them won't, and they'll probably be fine in terms of how their knee's doing at 28. But I can also give you a lot of examples of patients of mine that were told that by someone else, and they have an arthritic knee and they're 28. That's the problem. Is that some people are told not to do those things, and they don't get that when their knee gives out and gets swollen every time they go out to play basketball, that they're causing more and more damage. It lasts like 3 weeks in their brain that they're not supposed to do that sport, and doesn't always get driven home. But I have a lot of women patients who have lasted 20 years, and they don't really have any arthritis because they've been careful about what they do. They limit themselves. But if you just have a patient with an ACL tear and you just say, go ahead and do whatever you do, I guarantee you that group versus the group that has the surgery, the group that does whatever they want to do and has repetitive giving way episodes, they're going to be far more arthritic than the group that had the surgery, if you take all comers. So it just depends on, you know, what that person's going to do with their knee. If they're really careful and they protect it, then they'll probably do okay. But if they don't mind and they just go play basketball or soccer and just continue to abuse their knee, they're going to accelerate that rate of decay even faster than if they had the surgery. So that's...
Excuse me?
Yes.
What does ADL stand for?
Just activities of daily living. Every once in a while, someone will, like, they just step off a curb, you know, and they're not doing anything really sporty, and despite having a lot of rehab, their knee gives way.
Thank you. So
when we do the surgery... After the patient's got all their motion back and the knee's nice and quiet and moves nice and easy, this is the part that pisses the knee off again. We drill holes in the bone because we can't just reattach a new ACL where the old ACL was on the surface. So we drill a hole here and we drill a hole in the femur and then we pass a replacement graft, that's what we call it, in the exact spot of where the old ACL attached. Now, generally, this new replacement structure or graft is a tendon, in all cases, actually, because we can't take an ACL from the other knee because that would make that knee unstable. So we use a tendon. We usually use, there's different types of graft choices. There's allograft and there's which is from someone else, another cadaver graft, or we use the patient's own tissue. So there are different choices. We can use patient's own patellar tendon, or patient's own inside hamstrings, not the big ones in the back to the outside, or we can use cadaver graft, patellar tendon, or their Achilles allograft, or hamstrings. There's lots of different choices. The main difference between them, obviously, is this is from the patient, and this is from someone else. And everybody's probably thinking, well, that seems like an easy choice. Let's just take it from someone else, because then you don't have all that pain of taking a graft from the patient. The problem is that this has a much higher failure rate than this. And the reason is that all the tissue is pretty strong when you first put it in there, but this has your own cells in it, the patient's own cells, and it accepts the blood supply a lot faster. When we put the replacement graft in those tunnels, it attaches to the bone, and then it goes under a process called ligamentization where it kind of turns into an ACL, if you want to call it that. And if your own cells are already in there, it's going to accept the blood supply right away. If it's something taken from someone else, it's been frozen and it's been mildly irradiated and it's basically dead and it doesn't have any cells in it anymore. So this is going to take a lot longer to mature and get a blood supply. And we think it's on the order of 1+ years for this to be ready for the stress of playing sports. This is a lot faster. You know, Adrian Peterson, he's back playing football at like 6 months. This is like 1+ year. So you can imagine, not a great choice for a teenager who's not going to listen to me. Yes?
So why isn't it an allograft of another ACL on it?
Because it's hard to match the size. Everybody's ACL is a little different, and we don't pull them off a shelf and, like, take the 31-millimeter one. Yeah. I used to wonder that when I was a resident, like, maybe we should do, like, ACL transplants. But then I realized everybody has a different length. And you'd also have to, like, sew it in on the surfaces, and it would be very difficult. You'd have to do a big incision as opposed to the littler stuff that we do nowadays where it's all arthroscopic assisted. You'd have to open a whole knee up and then sew it down, and it wouldn't be very secure. And then the whole sizing thing, like, we don't have a bunch of ligaments on the shelf, whereas tendons come really long, and we just trim into what we need. So when I decide a graft choice, it's, yes, go ahead.
Do you do ACL reconstruction when the meniscus is gone?
When the meniscus is completely gone? I might do a transplant along with it of the meniscus and then ACL reconstruction based on the patient's age. But again, that cartilage surface on the end of the bones has got to be in good shape. So if the cartilage is no good, then the meniscus transplant is going to get chewed up. So there are some people that might do it, but I don't think it's a great idea because it just gets chewed up. So when we're deciding on the ACL reconstruction, these are the things that I think about. I don't just choose one type of graft for everybody, because there's good things for some people, not so good things for others. So I consider the strength of the graft, what its biological properties are in terms of, like, you know, allograft versus the patient's own tissue, how tough the patient is, a patellar tendon graft. You saw you take a piece of bone from the kneecap and the middle third of the patellar tendon and a piece of bone from the shin. That's pretty painful. In fact, I have to give a whole other level of pain medicine for that surgery versus using the hamstrings or the allograft. What does the patient do for sports? You take a piece of bone from here and here in the middle third of the tendon, you're not going to want to be diving on your knees anytime soon. Adrian Peterson had a patellar tendon graft, but he has knee pads and dives on a soft ground. Probably one of the reasons that sometimes basketball players struggle with that, because they don't have knee pads on. They're diving on a hard surface on the basketball court. But there's no perfect graft for everybody, so I have to balance things out for people. So that's why you may hear about, you know, your nieces or nephews that have ACL surgery and, you know, why they do that versus that. There's lots of things that come into consideration about how we're going to decide. This is why allograft's not the best choice if someone wants a speedy recovery. I work over at Cal taking care of the athletes, and unfortunately, every once in a while, we have an athlete come in that some surgeon has talked to them about getting you doing allograft ACL reconstruction because they'll recover faster, which is a little bit of a misnomer. They feel better faster because they don't have pain from getting that tendon from somewhere in their knee. They just had the tunnels drilled and passed up and the ACL fixed into position. So they don't have as much post-op pain, but the graft itself is not ready as fast as if we use their own tissue. And it's a constant struggle. I've had gymnasts like, I don't want to have a big incision. I want to have the allograft because I want to feel better faster. I'm like, okay, then I'm not letting you go back to gymnastics for a year. And I usually win that argument. Because then they think about being delayed 6 months more, then they're more willing to go with the autograft with their own tissue. So, you know, you lose it, it has to be repopulated with your own cells. So that's why it's a great choice for that patient who's older, that wants to get back to sports, that I'm worried about stiffness. I want to make the surgery a little bit easier. And, you know, the one thing that we have when we're 30-plus that 16-year-olds don't have is patience, right? And most of my patients that are over, even over 28, that are have jobs, the job or their kids get in the way of doing their rehab, and they're a little nervous about going back to sports anyway. And usually I'm like, come on, go to the gym, get strong. You got to do this work. I can't let you go back skiing until you can show me that you can meet these functional things. You got to be able to jump and land on the knee. You got to be able to do these things. And they're like, oh, I have been traveling. I'm working 16 hours a day, da, da, da. And so a year is probably fine. And I saw three people today that I was like, you know, originally they were like, how fast is it going to take me? And I was like, if you work hard, it's 6 months. If you don't work hard, it could be a year. And here we are at a year, and I'm still trying to get them to get stronger. So the allograft's not a bad choice for as people get older. In fact, the failure rate gets pretty close when people are 40 between allograft and autograft. But in a teenager, the allograft failure rate's 25%. For ACL surgery and versus 6% for them using their own tissues. That's a huge difference. So if you get nothing out of this talk, if you have like a niece or nephew that's in high school that's getting ACL surgery, don't let them get an allograft. So that's the chart. This is the failure rate for allograft. This is the failure rate for autograft. So you can see a huge difference. This is a little higher in here because that's the I'm not going to listen to you and do whatever I want stays here. What does Dr. Allen know? I can play soccer at 4 months. So, all right. So, enough about ACL. So we'll go to the next one. 21-year-old linebacker is hit on the outside of his knee by an opposing player. He feels his knee collapse in immediately and has a tearing sensation on the inside of his knee. He's helped off the sideline with his athletic trainer, but as he's not able to go back to the game, his knee swells a mild amount after the injury, and mostly over the inside part of his knee. Most likely diagnosis is A, patellar tendon rupture, B, medial collateral ligament injury. You guys don't even need the rest of the talk. You already got the answer. C, bursitis, or D, patella dislocation. So, all right, the answer is medial collateral ligament injury. So this is why in addition to getting a medial collateral ligament and an ACL tear, they outlawed clipping. So, all right, so MCL injury, getting hit on the outside of the knee. It's obviously much easier to get an MCL injury than a lateral collateral ligament injury because how often do you get hit this way? Not very often. You'd have to be like throwing the football and somebody coming from this way. It's pretty rare. So metacollateral injuries are pretty common, probably the most common knee ligament injury. Sometimes it's caused by a twisting injury, and sometimes it's really hard for me to sort out, is this a meniscus injury, or is this a metacollateral ligament injury, or is it both? So sometimes I have to see patients back, make sure that they feel stable on exam and that their pain goes away to convince myself that the two things aren't in combination. So this is a sprain of the medial collateral ligament. But sometimes you can have this in combination with an ACL. So this doesn't cause much swelling. Patients will just have some swelling over here, not in the joint, because the medial collateral ligament is mostly outside the joint except at the joint line where it attaches to the meniscus. So people tear this, they just get swelling here. If someone has a large amount of swelling, it's probably a combined injury, and then we need to be concerned. Sometimes when people get this gets injured enough for a higher grade injury, they really get clipped and they get a grade 3, which is like a complete tear and the whole thing gaps open and I feel like I can run out of the room with the knee this way. Sometimes the bones on this side smack into each other and then they get what we call bone bruises and a lot of swelling in the joint too. Or sometimes even a fracture or a meniscus tear to the outside, because you imagine you get clipped here, this opens up, and these two bones smack into each other. So that's a bad. See, I feel like I could run out of the room with the ankle because the knee opens up. So, you know, this should be straight, and this is a grade 3 MCL injury. Generally, we can treat these non-operatively because the medial collateral ligament has a great blood supply, as opposed to the ACL where the two ends lop away from each other. The MCL just goes like this in most cases. Every once in a while it's a bad one and these pieces like flip into the joint, but that's very, very rare. So generally we treat with bracing, and how much opening or gapping the ligament has or the grade of the injury determines how we brace. Sometimes it's like a low grade sprain, a grade 1 or grade 2, and we just put a short hinge knee brace on the patient, send them to physical therapy, maybe crutches just to get the swelling down. If it's a really high grade, like that one on the previous page, sometimes I'll lock the patient in a brace. In the old days, they used to just cast people for 6 weeks and to get the medial collateral ligament to heal. Rarely, like I said, do they need surgery unless they're combined with something else. So non-operative, no, this is not much swelling. The main important thing is that we got to brace the person, because otherwise if it heals loose, then they're going to have giving way symptoms. All right, case number 4. An 18-year-old gymnast turns on her planted foot when she's doing a tumbling routine. She immediately feels a pop in her knee and has excruciating pain. Her knee gives out on her, and she falls to the mat, rolling around, screaming. She attempts to straighten her knee out. She notices something's wrong with her knee. And then it kind of fixes herself as the knee's straightened out, and the trainer comes out to help her. But weirdly, her ligament exam is completely stable after the injury. So the most likely diagnosis is A, meniscus tear, B, ACL tear, C, hamstring strain, or D, patella dislocation. Very good. Okay. So this one's going to swell a lot overnight, too. In fact, sometimes people can tear their ACL and dislocate their patella at the same time. The literature says 30% of the time. I don't find that to be the case. I think it's a little less than that. But those are the weird ones where you're like trying to figure out if it's one thing or the other or both. All right. So this is something we rarely see. Is someone sitting in the emergency room with the patella dislocated? Generally, if the trainer goes out to the field or doctor, as you try to straighten the knee out, the patella just spontaneously goes back into place. Oftentimes, in this particular scenario, sometimes the patellar tendon's torn or there's a fracture that's keeping the kneecap out of place. But that obviously is not normal. You see that, you know that there's a serious problem. Doesn't take a rocket science to figure that one out. All right. So the mechanism for injuring or dislocating the patella is very similar to when people tear their ACL. It's the same kind of planted foot, externally rotated, and then torquing on it. So and then the kneecap always pops out with pretty much 99.999% of the time it pops out laterally. Usually it happens during athletics. Sometimes, occasionally, like happened to me, which got me into orthopedics, you can get a direct blow to the kneecap. I had someone slide tackle me and hit me here and dislocated my kneecap. You have swelling right away because there's blood vessels that go to that those two ligaments that keep the kneecap stable. And they, when the medial retinaculum, that's kind of the strap that keeps it in place, tears, there's blood vessels that bleed, and then you get bleeding within a few hours. Definitely more prevalence in gals, teenage gals, than guys for a variety of reasons, oftentimes having to do with differences in strength, differences in core strength. Gals tend to be knock-knee. There's a lot of different reasons. So in the office, when you try to push the patient's kneecap to the outside, out this way, call this the apprehension sign because the patient looks like they're going to smack you if you try to dislocate their kneecap. But the predilection for this injury is 16-year-old gal, knock-kneed, poor core strength, those are the main things. Sometimes very flat feet. So all these things dynamically tend to pull the knees in, and the line of pull of the muscles is out this way. And oftentimes very loosey-goosey, hyperextension of the elbows, and ligamentous laxity. And that's the classic athlete that gets patella dislocations. Generally, when the first time person dislocates, we treat them non-operatively. The emergency room will often put people in a knee immobilizer and on crutches for this injury, which is kind of the kiss of death because the patient may take a few weeks to get in for an office visit, and meanwhile their quad is shrinking in this knee immobilizer, and they don't know that they're supposed to do exercises, and they get stiff. So we try to get these patients in. That's why our clue to the schedulers is get anybody in with a swollen knee right away, because either way, we want to get that patient treated or into physical therapy or scheduled for surgery, depending on what it is. But for the patellar dislocations, I want to get the patient in a brace right away that's going to treat them correctly and get them into physical therapy right away. I don't want them to sit around for 3 weeks getting a weak muscles in their leg. So this is what we call PTO stabilizer brace, and I wish emergency rooms would just put people in these. There, you can see there's this hard piece of plastic here. This is a right knee brace. The kneecap's here, and this piece of plastic is designed to push the kneecap over where it's supposed to be so that those ligaments that got stretched out over here don't end up all loose. Imagine if you pop your kneecap out, and then all the swelling makes the kneecap sit to the outside, and this ligament here that got stretched out is just allowed to just kind of hang out at that that stretched out length, or if it's torn off the bone. If we don't do something to get it back to where it needs to be healed, then the patient's going to have repeat episodes of instability. And then you combine that with them getting weak. It's just asking for trouble. So we want to do physical therapy, put them in a brace, and then hopefully get them back to sports more like 3 or 4 months because they have a lot of swelling and they have to get their strength back. The only exception to this in terms of when we do surgery on someone that's dislocated their kneecap for the first time is if they shear a piece of bone and cartilage off their kneecap, which can happen. If you can imagine, it's pretty traumatic. Your kneecap pops over, and it hits all the bone on the outside of the trochlea, which the kneecap glides against. So here's your trochlea, and here's your kneecap. If it goes boom like that, when it hits over here, you could shear cartilage and bone off that edge, or on the undersurface of the kneecap. And if someone has a big piece of cartilage and bone that they took off, we want to try to fix that right away if it's big enough. may happen about 10% of the time. We have to put screws in it, and it's a pretty big surgery, but once that cartilage is knocked off, we can't just glue it back 10 months later. We want to try to fix the piece of cartilage and bone. So that's the that's the one exception to the rule about treating people for dislocations. Yes?
I've never understood exactly what the kneecap is for. Is it just protection of the joint?
Well, it protects the joint. It also can cause problems to the joint because if you land on your knee and your kneecap gets driven into trochlea. But it also increases the moment arm of the extensor mechanism. So it has to do with engineering mechanics. You have this bone that offsets the patellar and quad tendon, and that increases the strength of the quad by having that offset. In fact, if people have, if they have their kneecap taken out for some reason, like they have a bad fracture, people lose about 30% of their quadriceps strength because you've taken the patella out. So that proves the point. But basically, it's like an offset. It's not really truly a pulley mechanism, but it's an offset to increase the strength of the quad. So, all right. So generally, we do non-operative treatment of first-time dislocators, but there's still pretty high recurrence rate because of anatomy, maybe because people don't get strong, maybe their therapy is not the greatest. So what do we do if someone keeps dislocating? You know, we don't want to keep just popping out, because that causes cartilage damage. So this is the gory pictures here, because this is real blood and guts instead of my diet schematics. So we do a few things that help. One is we take away the tightness to the outside, because oftentimes if someone sits over here kind of perched all the time and they're dislocating, the lateral retinaculum, the outside strap, ends up being tight, so we can release that arthroscopically. Cut it with this hot cautery device, and then it heals a little lengthened. Then we tighten up the inside part that it has healed, stretched out, or we call it a reefing procedure. This has nothing to do with medical marijuana. So we tighten up that stretched out retinaculum to the inside, the check rein, which is actually the most important part of making the kneecap stable. Or sometimes if it's really stretched out and it's really tissue paper thin, sometimes we'll add a hamstring graft, another graft, to make that stouter or stronger, recreate that check rein. So we call that a reconstruction. Now, that sometimes is enough, but sometimes when people have a lot of alignment issues, you know, the girl that's like this had a lot of hip rotation. Sorry, you guys can't see me like this. It's an awkward phase. Sometimes the line of pull, because the kneecap attachment through the patellar tendon is way over here in some people. You may look at some people's knees and it's like, wow, their bump where their patellar tendon attaches way over to the outside, like this one. Most people, it goes kind of straight down and centered on the front of the tibia here. But you can imagine if the quad attaches at the top of the hip, and then you have this quad tendon down to the kneecap, and then the other end of the patellar tendon attachment, which is this all extensor mechanism, is way over here, then the line of pull of the kneecap is to the outside. So you have this big pull over here. You combine that with a little knock knee, a little pronated feet, and you got a nice little cocktail for dislocation. And then you have a loose ligament over here. So sometimes just tightening up the medial retinaculum and releasing the tight lateral retinaculum isn't enough. And so we need to do some sort of bony procedure. We need to do an alignment correction. And most people are like, you are like, what? You're going to cut bone? But we basically swing this bony attachment of the patellar tendon over this way so that the line of pull is straight, and it takes away some of that force vector, we're getting into mechanics and engineering, that makes it want to dislocate. And we call that a Fulkerson osteotomy. And what we're doing is we're changing that Q angle between the attachment of the quad mechanism up at the hip and the attachment of the patellar tendon down at the tibia, and trying to make this a little bit less of an angle so that the patella doesn't want to constantly dislocate. So this is a rough procedure, as you imagine, because I'm cutting the bone and then swinging this piece over. Go ahead.
Can you do that? Don't you have to do it on both knees? Are they going to be crooked?
No. We're changing the line of pull of the kneecap, but we're not changing the way someone is. Like, we're not straightening out things. Although there is a procedure where you can actually straighten the femur out and take away some of this. Those you'd probably want to do the same. But remember, there's another part of this dislocation that may not be on the other side, which is the loose medial retinaculum. And so the other side may never have dislocated, even though they've had this problem. So you don't just profile. I mean, in fact, you wouldn't want to do this surgery on both knees at the same time, because they wouldn't be able to walk. So we don't do it. We don't necessarily do it prophylactically. But there are many patients that have had to do one knee and then the other because they dislocate both kneecaps, but you don't really do them both at the same time because you need one good leg to get down the stairs. So they have to, usually they're about 9 months apart. So, okay, so gory picture number two. So we cut the bone and then we rotate this over. Rotate this over and then we fix it with screws. And then they got 9 months of rehab. So it's even longer than ACL surgery, I think. So, but this is kind of the thing that really makes them stable, because you're correcting an alignment issue, an line of pull issue with a kneecap dislocating. So, as you can use, as you imagine, I use a lot of power tools. So, all right. Dad would be proud. All right, 55-year-old heavyset male is walking down the stairs of the plane when he has a misstep. As he attempts to catch himself to prevent falling down the stairs, he feels a painful tearing sensation in his knee, and his knee collapses underneath him. He presents for evaluation with his wife, Hillary, and with significant swelling in the front of his knee, difficulty with performing a straight leg raise, and his kneecap, for some reason, compared to the other one, is sitting a little bit low. Most likely diagnosis is... Oh, yeah, and he has a loss. Oh, it says swelling. Meniscus tear, ACL tear, patellar tendon rupture, or quadriceps tendon rupture. Oh, split audience on this one. Okay, so anybody knows American history? One of our esteemed presidents, whose wife is ex-Secretary of State, did this. He was walking down, I think it was Air Force One, and he slipped and ruptured his quad tendon. So when the quad tendon ruptures, the kneecap drops down. So, because there's a disconnect between the kneecap and the quadriceps tendon. So quad tendon ruptures tend to happen a little bit older patient population. Oftentimes these tendon ruptures happen because we call it an eccentric contraction. The muscle is on stretch, and then you pull on it more. So if you're going down the stairs and the muscle's already contracting and then it gets stressed a little bit more, that can rupture it. Typically patients older than 40, pretty rare in the young athlete, unless there may be steroids involved or something like that. There's a few of these in the NFL. It's 3 times more common than patellar tendon ruptures, and people can actually have both rupture at the same time, like if they slip and they fall on their knees. Generally there's some tendinopathy, like the tendon may not be super healthy, and that may be some pre-existing pain where the patellar tendon or the quad tendon inserts at the top of the kneecap, some warning signs, but not always. So this is a normal extensor mechanism, the quad tendon, which goes up into the quad muscle up higher, the kneecap, and then the patellar tendon inserting on the tibia. Now on the other side, here's the patellar tendon, patella, and then just the rupture of the tendon off the bone, and then the rest of the quad tendon. So the kneecap tends to drop down because it's not attached to the muscle. So we get patella, baja. So the patient, if you ask them to do a straight leg raise, lock their leg out and lift it up as a unit, or ask them to lift their leg up and then extend it, they have trouble doing it. This patient has a quad tendon rupture. So that's an extensor lag. And then they can actually sometimes feel the divot here, and there's a lot of pain. That's the other way I can differentiate where the tendon rupture is just by doing this, or we can do an ultrasound or sometimes an MRI. So another gory picture. End of the quad tendon. The patient's head is up this way in this picture. And basically what we do for this is reattach Humpty Dumpty. We put sutures through the tendon, pass the sutures through the bone by drilling holes, and then tie the sutures on the other end of the kneecap so we have a nice firm repair. Get everything back together again. This is another one of those recovery times, relatively long, because we got to get this tendon to heal back to the bone. And the annoying part of this particular surgery is the patient has to be locked straight for 6 to 8 weeks so that you don't put a lot of stress on this. And we gradually increase how much motion they have over that 6-week time period to get this to heal. So, but they're usually a pretty successful surgery, especially if we get them right away, because again, lots of swelling. Red flag to the schedulers that they need to get this in right away. So, okay, conversely, a 40-year-old male recreational basketball player is driving to the basket for the winning layup during a pickup game. As he lands after doing the layup, he feels a painful pop in his knee, and his knee collapses underneath him. He presents for evaluation with a lot of swelling in the front of his knee. He can't do a straight leg raise, and his patella is sitting high compared to the other knee. Most likely diagnosis is A, meniscus tear, B, ACL tear, C, patellar tendon rupture. And D, quadriceps tendon rupture. All right, good, D. I mean, C, sorry. Long day. So patellar tendon rupture is oftentimes due to a traumatic type of injury. Very common in basketball and a little bit younger age group. Bilateral ruptures can also occur in this age group, but not as common as in quad tendon ruptures. By far the most common mechanism of injury that I see is with basketball. Usually the tendon is torn off the bottom of the kneecap, although I have seen mid-substance ruptures. And a guy that tore his ACL, tore through the middle of his patellar tendon, which I've never seen before. So he had a really bad injury. But I've also seen people pull it off with a piece of bone from the tibial side, too. But the most common location is off the bottom of the kneecap. Mid-substance rupture is unusual. My patient, he's kind of anal. The one that had the mid-substance rupture, and he like looked up that University of Missouri football player had the same injury as him. And why isn't he recovered yet? And I'm like, well, A, he's 15 years younger than you. So, again, there's oftentimes a history of some tendon degeneration problems, repetitive trauma to the tendon with this age group. So in this case, patella is sitting a little higher, and here's the tendon. Normal tendon's jet black on these images, and then there's just a disruption off the bottom of the kneecap. Sometimes people pull a piece of bone off also, but that's not so usual. So, anybody knows who Ronaldo is? He tore his patellar tendon playing soccer. Lots of swelling because you have bleeding from the tendon. This is a good one. Is this my guy? So this is the bottom of the kneecap. This patient kind of pulled it off the bottom of the kneecap and then delaminated the tendon. So there's the bottom. This is the bottom of the kneecap, and this is the tendon. And this is pulling the tendon back up to the kneecap here. And again, what we do is we put drill holes through the kneecap, through the bony part, obviously not through the cartilage part, and pass sutures that go all the way down to the normal tendon and back up across the kneecap, and we tie the sutures up at the top end of the kneecap so we get a nice firm repair. And the rehab for this is very much like the quadriceps tendon rupture that I talked about. Braces locked straight, crutches for 6 to 8 weeks, gradually increasing the motion of the patient. Because you do one of these repairs, you don't want someone to bend their knee to 120 degrees the first day post-op because they'll put too much stress on the ligament. And we call it a tendon, but really it's a ligament. We don't want to put too much stress at that interface between where the patellar tendon is trying to reattach the bone. You want to keep that. You don't want to have much motion in there. You want tendon to bone healing. So, all right. So last case. This is where people get confused because it's like, there's a spectrum of cartilage injuries, and the most extreme spectrum is no cartilage, which equals arthritis. But sometimes people have traumatic injuries to the cartilage. Fall off your bike, land on your knee, and you knock off a pretty big chunk of cartilage, and patients have a lot of swelling because the bone bleeds. That's a acute injury as opposed to chronic wear and tear, which is more arthritis. So in a direct trauma type of situation, someone lands on their knee, someone tears their ACL, sometimes they can knock a piece of cartilage off too in a traumatic type of situation. Sometimes people just have like a piece of cartilage that's catching or causing a lot of symptoms. So these are some of my patients who had ACL tears and they knocked pieces of cartilage off. The knee gives way. And this is why we don't want to let someone play sports and just give way with their knee because they do this type of stuff. This is a patient of mine who tore his ACL like 2 years earlier, didn't get treatment, kept trying to play basketball, couldn't put two and two together that the knee giving way caused a swelling and was causing damage to his knee. And then he finally came in when he started having pain and locking symptoms. So he knocked a whole piece of cartilage off the end of his femur. And it was floating around in the middle of, right in front of where the intercondylar notch was. And occasionally it would like lock him from getting straight. You know, it's a pretty big chunk of bone, of cartilage that's floating around. And it will make the knee lock up. This patient, it almost looks like it's not real because it's a nice perfect circle. She had knocked off a piece of cartilage off of her femur. So these types of things, these kind of traumatic type of injuries. In younger patients, we can fix these things with different types of surgeries. When there are discrete areas, this one's a little bit difficult because it's kind of big, as you can see, but they're nice, round, defined images as opposed to cartilage wear where things are just worn down. It's a huge area. So one thing we can do to a confined area in a younger patient is we can do what we call microfracture, where we poke holes into the bone, into the subchondral bone, where there's a good blood supply, and there's actually stem cells and bone marrow cells under the surface of the bone. So we poke these holes with this little sharp instrument. We call this Stedman drilling. It's not really, we don't use a drill because heat's not good for a bone, but we poke holes into the subchondral bone, and you see if we turn off the arthroscopy fluid, they all bleed. And the bone marrow cells come to the surface, and then given the right growing conditions, kind of like growing a plant, cartilage, fiber cartilage can fill in where this exposed bone is. See how all this yellow is? That's all exposed bone, where the cartilage has gotten scuffed off. And we do the microfracture. This bleeding has the marrow cells, which can differentiate. This is this whole thing about stem cells nowadays, and differentiate into fiber cartilage cells and cover the surface with, I call it shag carpet, because it's not that perfect linoleum-like hyaline cartilage, but at least we don't have exposed bone. So it's not perfect, but at least it's a covering. And this is what they do typically with the NBA players. They get these things, and then they do well for 3 or 4 years. It's not super durable like the linoleum-like hyaline cartilage I was talking about earlier, but at least it's a covering to allow people to continue playing sports. Everybody's probably like, well, why can't I have this for my arthritic knee? Well, the problem with this procedure is that it seems to hit, you have a expiration date sometimes on your bone marrow cells. And this doesn't seem to work very well in the face of arthritis with hard bone that's gotten arthritic. And I don't think that the bone marrow cells are as virile about getting replacement fiber cartilage. So the results in doing microfracture in someone that's over like 40 are not that great, because otherwise this would be great. So that's why we are constantly looking at cartilage regeneration procedures. And Dr. Ma, I think, already talked to you. Yeah, he probably talked to you about this at length. But that's why we're looking at NeoCart or there's this juvenile cartilage that you can put in, because our own cells aren't so great when we hit a certain age. About filling in arthritic areas. But this works great in a 20-year-old because their bone marrow cells are pretty active and they can differentiate into fibrocartilage. So this is just an example of one. You know, there's a nice, well-defined lesion. It's about maybe a centimeter in size, and then we drill these holes, and then it bleeds. And then replacement cartilage. Yeah, this is hyaline cartilage, nice and hard-looking. It's kind of like linoleum, but the fiber cartilage that fills in its place is more shaggy, like the edges of the cartilage here. But it fills in a nice fluffy surface, and you don't have exposed bone, so it's less pain for the patient for activities. It's not ideal, but it's a good procedure to get people back to sports. But in the efforts of making things last longer, we keep coming up with these new ideas, such as, people probably heard of Carticel procedure. There are new things coming down the pike, which Dr. Ma talked about. But the Carticel procedure needs two surgeries, where you take some of the patient's cartilage out. It goes through a manufacturing process, specifically at Genzyme for this company. But there's other things. I'm not proprietary at all. They culture the cells, and they get millions of cells. Then you put it back into where the defect is, and you cover it over with a patch. This requires, because we have to cover it over a patch, you have to sew it back in with these really fine sutures. This means we can't do this arthroscopically, so it's a pretty big incision for the patient, very big recovery. So this is a much bigger surgery than doing the microfracture, where you can do that all through those little arthroscopic 1-centimeter incisions. This has to be a big exposure, big arthrotomy of the knee, to flip the kneecap out of the way to be able to get access to sew these in. So there's a lot of variations on this surgery coming down the pike, where maybe we can glue a patch of cartilage cells in. You might be able to do that arthroscopically. But all that's in the developmental stage, and there's some things going through FDA trials and different things. But the problem with cartilage is it is very sophisticated, and it has it's not just a bunch of cells in some gobbledygook. Each layer of the cartilage has a function. There are some that are supposed to take shear stress and some that are supposed to take compressive loads. And so trying to get that architecture right and growing it in manufacturing is very difficult. And even these cells, we may put these in here, and they don't always know what to do. And sometimes it just grows fiber cartilage just like the microfracture, and it doesn't grow back hyaline cartilage. The Swedes who invented this have great results, and they say they get hyaline cartilage, that nice hard linoleum stuff. The rest of us, for some reason, just get fiber cartilage because we're not as good as them in doing the surgery. But it's not as predictable as we had hoped. So we're constantly looking at how do we get that normal architecture back with something, with some surgical procedure. This is the untapped field or the growing field of cartilage replacement. So like in a trochlear lesion, this is the patch that I've sewed in. You can imagine how these are little, very fine sutures like this. They're about the thickness of a hair thread. So lots of work. And the cells are all underneath this. We've sewn this in, left a little hole, inject the cells, and then seal it with fiber and glue around the edges to keep the cells trapped in there. And then the replacement cartilage grows. So the other option for very small defects is to take cartilage plugs from somewhere else in the knee. The ideal thing about this is that you're taking normal cartilage from somewhere else to fill a defect where the patient has pain. The not ideal thing is you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. But there are some places that you can take a piece of bone, like a cylinder of bone with the cartilage over it, there's not that much morbidity for the patient. Like at the right up at the top of the trochlea here, where the kneecap doesn't really glide against as much. But you only have so many places that you can steal from before it becomes a problem in the place you stole from. So but if someone has, like in this picture, this is the end of the femur. Someone has a kind of small cartilage defect. We can take some plugs from somewhere else. I don't even know if I'd want to take four like this image is, and put them in here so that when the patient's walking, they don't have that persistent pain. But you can't, you know, if someone's arthritic and the wear is this whole area, you can't do that. You don't have enough sources to take it from. And unfortunately, we don't allograft plugs, which would be a great option. They don't oftentimes last as long as taking the own cartilage from the patient. If we can work on preserving allograft plugs, this would be a great option. And sometimes people have like round cylindrical defects, and we'll actually get a whole fresh end of a femur and take a big plug and put it in here. And that's kind of the extreme example, and we don't have any other options for a younger patient that has a significant cartilage and bone defect. So we'll do allograft plugs, but super expensive because you got to get a fresh, it's not even frozen, it's a fresh femur from a donor that's passed away in an accident. So when we put a plug in, we core out the old bone and cartilage, well, there's no cartilage there, and then we put a plug in to fill the defect. And this is the patient that I showed earlier that had like the round cylindrical bone exposed. This is right after surgery, and this is, I think it was 6 years later. Looks pretty good. She had a meniscus tear, so I got to look and see how my work had held up a little bit. So, okay, that's it. So, what do you guys, somebody asked you a question about knee injuries. These are the things that need to be seen right away. We didn't really talk about fractures, but that's a whole other, that's a big topic. Note that the common theme for all these things is sudden traumatic injury, a lot of swelling, oftentimes immediate locking type symptoms in some of them. Those are the things that you need to encourage someone that you know, if they tell you about these things, that they need to get treatment right away and don't sit on it. Because it's a lot harder to treat these delayed, especially the tendon ruptures, than treating them immediately. So, okay, what things could get better? Some of the other people have talked about these things. Maybe a little bit of a meniscus tear in someone older. Maybe we could try rehab first and injection. I want you to think I'm all about surgery. In answer to your question, arthritis with a meniscus tear, you don't always treat surgically. Bilateral knee pain usually is either arthritis or kneecap pain. kneecap pain can be treated with physical therapy, tendonitis. So a lot of these, the common theme with these things, overuse injury, gradual onset, usually not a lot of swelling. So, all right. All right.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.